Last lecture, one of you told me he's not yet convinced that one can calculate the probability amplitudes for the Fourier coefficients just as if it were a regular harmonic oscillator, just like it's a complex valued harmonic oscillator. As I said, you can calculate that from this representation with the x and the p's. It's a little bit tedious, but you can do it. Now, today, we're going to go from the Heisenberg picture to the Schrödinger picture of quantum field theory. And as part of that, I've added a slide or two to rewrite. Now, in the Schrödinger picture, how you get those probability amplitudes for the Fourier coefficients. And you will see exactly that they are just this Gaussian and so on. So remember the Heisenberg picture. So far, we've worked exclusively in the Heisenberg picture. The Hamiltonian looks like this. And the Heisenberg equations of motion, which are valid for all quantum theories, look like that. And in the particular case of this Hamiltonian, with the observables being phi hat and pi hat, those Heisenberg equations of motion specialize to become this equation of motion, and that one, the two of them together, implying the Kangorn equation. So what we have to solve in the Heisenberg picture is the Kangorn equation, the commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions on the fields. The adjoint of phi is phi, and the adjoint of pi is pi for each x. And in the Heisenberg picture, all those operators, the phi hat and the pi hat, are time dependent. The state of the system, as always in the Heisenberg picture, is just frozen in time. Then how did we proceed there? So our results so far are these. We obtained an explicit solution for phi hat of x and t. So we solved the equation of motion and the commutation relations and the hermeticity conditions, the whole thing, by making this ansatz, meaning that time-dependent operator valued field, this collection of operators, one for every x and embodied in time, can be expressed as a linear combination of those mode operators, which are not self-adjoint, those guys are, these are not. Where we put the system in a very, very large box, such that we were able to work with Fourier series coefficients rather than with a Fourier transform. So this Fourier expansion here is a discrete expansion where the values of k are discrete. They are triples of numbers, and each triple k is a triple of integers, n1, n2, and n3, multiplied with 2 pi over L, where L is the side length of the box. This had a significant advantage in that the commutation relations for the phi and the pi in the x representation turned into commutation relations for the phi and pi in the k representation, which had the Kronecker delta on the right-hand side rather than a Dirac delta. Also, in this way, we decoupled the harmonic oscillator. They became independent harmonic oscillators. Namely, those phi k obey each of them a harmonic oscillator equation like this, where the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is square root of k squared plus m squared. K, of course, being a triple, you can think of it as a state component vector, and k squared is its length squared. This wasn't quite a clean oscillator yet, because those things are not self-adjoint, so we can't directly use the results of regular quantum mechanical harmonic oscillators. But we showed that you can write those in terms of regular quantum harmonic oscillators, one at each quantum momentum space. Namely, the phi hat k is this linear combination of harmonic oscillators sitting at k and at minus k. this means that we can calculate everything, because these things act on a Hilbert space, and they act very concretely on that Hilbert space, because they can be expressed as linear combinations of those things, and these act very concretely on a Hilbert space, because they are linear combinations of those, and these act just as usual on the Hilbert space of any quantum harmonic oscillator. So remember that those phi and those q and those p are just linearly related to another. So if you have a Hilbert space representation, and anyone will do, if you take any Hilbert space representation of the q's and the p's of those harmonic oscillators that you place at every quantum momentum space, then you get from that a Hilbert space representation of the phi k and a Hilbert space representation of the phi.
So the probability of phi k can be calculated from the probability of the q k's and the probability.
Exactly, and also the phi. That's right. That the eigenstate. So this operator or that operator, and you ask what's the probability answer to find the right. So how do we make predictions? Well, simplest predictions are a bit like this. We assume that the phi hat of x and the phi hat of x are known explicitly. And we also assume that the state of the system is known. Remember that the state does not evolve in time, it's the operators that evolve in time. So for example, we could have given the phi hat and the phi hat in terms of the q, k, and the pk as we did above. It's not the only possibility, but it's one possibility. And they act on some Hilbert space. You just represent your harmonic oscillators any which way you like on a Hilbert space. For example, through differentiation multiplication operators or phasing going operators. Doesn't matter. Then you have a Hilbert space for each one of those on which each one of those QKs and PKs act. And that is also the Hilbert space on which all of those things act. So now you can calculate, for example, the expectation value when repeatedly measuring, for example, phi hat at a particular point in space at a particular time. So you repeat the experiment over and over again, and you have an ensemble of measurements. Then the expectation value for the outcome of the amplitude measurement at a particular point in space time is just the expectation value of that operator. Now, in practice, of course, you may wonder, how on earth do I measure a phi? Okay. It's a non-trivial thing. We just say that under certain circumstances, you can do, in essence, that. For example, as an electromagnetism, where a phi picture is often more appropriate than the photon picture. There are also other circumstances, and we will head towards those other ones, namely in cosmology, where the phi amplitude will have an impact onto the energy momentum tensor, which will curve space, and as I said, that translates into redshifts, which are then observed. Anyway, let's not be concerned too much with how we would actually measure the amplitude. Let's just say it's a self-adjoint operator, and according to mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics, you're permitted to think of it as an observer. Secondly, we may want to measure or predict the uncertainty that comes with the measurement of the field amplitude. See, if we run an ensemble of experiments, always setting up the system in the same state, always having the same dynamics, and we measure this observable phi hat of x at a particular time, at a particular experiment time, over and over and over again, each time, in principle, we get a different answer. It's just like measuring the position of a harmonic oscillator over and over again in the same, if you run the same experiment over and over again, you would find it at different positions every time again. If, for example, the harmonic oscillator is in its ground state, then the average position where you find it is zero. But in practice, whenever you do measurement, you will find it either on the right or on the left somewhere. It's just that it's as much on the right as it is on the left, and therefore the average is actually going to be just zero. The expectation value of the position of a harmonic oscillator is generally, and if it's zero, if it's in the ground state, for example. But that doesn't mean that the standard deviation in your run, in your experimental run, is also zero. But that would mean that you always find it as zero. Well, you have fluctuations to the left and to the right, and the magnitude of those fluctuations, the magnitude of the spread of the measurement outcomes is measured in the uncertainty. So, for example, we can calculate the uncertainty in a measurement of of the field amplitude in just the usual way we would do in quantum mechanics. Take the observable in question minus the expectation value. So it's the deviation from the mean, which we square to make sure that we always have something positive. And then we take the expectation value to get the variance and get the square root to get the standard deviation. In practice, it's not quite as easy as that. In principle, that's right. But in practice, we shouldn't really measure at one point. Or let's put it this way, we cannot measure at just one point. The point zero extent can never do it. And the mathematics is punishing us in principle for trying to do so. If you calculate that, you find infinity. But if, as we will later in this course see, you make a realistic assumption that you're not measuring the field at a point, but you're measuring a smeared out version of the field in patch. So if you admit that you can't measure the field from one point to the next point exactly, but instead you can only measure, you can only see the field in a coarse-grained way, then you get a finite answer.
Sure. Just confirm this field you're talking about is just basically the wave function from normal quantum mechanics. It's just that we're not sure what that wave function is anymore, so we're measuring that. Is that what you're saying?
No, it is true that I introduced the whole subject of second quantization by saying that second quantization makes the wave function itself uncertain, right? And you can view it as this way, but it's better to keep in mind that once you turn to relativity, don't even have to do second quantization, once you turn to a relativistic formulation, such as the Plancks equation, then the field doesn't have the interpretation anymore that the Schrödinger wave function would have. Maybe that is a modulus squared is the probability for finding a particle. It's just not so, because of the existence of antiparticles.
So then what interpretation does it have?
Well, for now, just take the field as fluctuating fields, and then in the next lecture, as we've started today, at the end of the lecture today, and then in the next lecture, we will see how the particle dimension is. Basically, we will take the field in space and we will say, let's put a detector in there, a detector for particles, and calculate the probabilities for the detector to register a particle, dependent on what space the field is in and what dynamics is in.
I have a question. While calculating probability of pk or qk, you fix the state of the harmonic oscillator. You said that either they were all in the ground state or they were all in the excited state or one was in the...
Yeah.
So that means that different field configurations can correspond to the same number of particles?
Yeah, sure. You can have five particles of low energies and five particles of high energies and a mixture and all of that. There are many ways of writing down states in which you're sure that you have five particles.
No, but like you say that let all particles be in the ground state. If all particles are in the ground state, can you still find different field configurations?
The harmonic oscillator is in the ground state, which means that there are no particles. But you will get to the particle interpretation. For now, just think of it as talking about fields and how they fluctuate. And as I said, there are certain circumstances in which the field interpretation makes sense, in which you can, in essence, more or less directly, but more indirectly usually, measure those observables. Not in accelerator physics, but, for example, in cosmology. But then there are other circumstances in which it is better to think of it differently, namely as predicting the presence or absence or collisions of particles. But we haven't gone that far yet, how particles could ever emerge in this. Right, so now instead of measuring phi hat of x or t, the observable phi that sits at the point x for any x in three. we can also equivalently consider those operators, the phi hat k of t, which are, after all, since they're free transforms of those, they're just linear combinations of those. So they're just linear combinations of those other operators. We can always separate the imaginary from the real part, and so on. So we can look at those operators instead. And there is a distinct advantage to doing this. The reason being that those operators form a continuous set. There's a continuum of them. For each x, there is a phi. There's a phi operator. But here, this index k runs only through discrete values. And that's helpful. It will avoid some technical problems. And of course, also they are decoupled harmonic oscillators. So we can ask, what is the probability amplitude for finding any one of those phi k coefficients, where phi k now would be an eigenvalue of the phi k hat. What's the probability of finding particular this, the big part of this as the eigenvalue to the, and the imaginary part that as the eigenvalue to the, coming to the anti-servitor part. What's the probability amplitude for finding such a Fourier coefficient? Well, we choose a state of our quantum field. Could be the vacuum state, for example. So it could be the state in which all of those Q and P oscillators are in their ground state. For now, we take this to be the definition of the vacuum state or the ground state. But we could take any arbitrary state, of course. Let's just use this definition that we call this lowest energy state of the Q and P oscillators, psi naught, and we call it the vacuum state. Well then, remember from ordinary harmonic oscillators, ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators, that the probability for finding the oscillating object at position q is given by the probability amplitude that you obtain by taking the bracket between the position eigenvector and the vector that describes the state in which the system is in our case, ground state. And for a quantum harmonic oscillator, this, the wave function of the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, the position wave function, if q stands for position now, is of course given by e to the power minus omega k q squared half. And from this, as I suggested last time, you can calculate that indeed, if you work it out for the phi k, you can find the probability amplitude for finding a particular value for phi k is given by a constant times this expression here, which is similar to that. It looks like a Gaussian here. And it is a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian for the real part, a Gaussian for the imaginary part. Because it is e to the power of minus omega k half phi k star, which is the same as phi k phi minus. So I left you hanging with this last time. I said, all right, you figure it out exactly how that comes about. Yes?
That's just curious, because you said that the probability amplitude is no longer just the modulus square, or is it actually what you have looked on here?
This is the modulus square.
Okay.
It is. So in other words, Mukhanov and Vinitsky are justified in just glossing over this issue completely and just treating it as like a harmonic oscillator with complex amplitudes and turning this usual result into that result here. But as I showed you, it's not quite trivial because there are some minor signs and some non-trivial linear transformation to the Q's and the P's that have justified IQ. But since we know the theory completely in terms of the Q's and P's, this can be calculated. And then you can do the following. Now that you have the probability distribution, the constant has to be fixed such that over a normalized form, which is not hard to look up or to calculate. It means that you can now, for example, just to get a picture like this, and you can do it, you can draw values from that probability distribution, just at random. So with low probability, you get large modulus of 5k, with high probability, you get some values close to 1, it's Gaussian distributed, and the phase the face of this complex number is uniformly distributed because the probability distribution doesn't depend on it. Right, so you can draw these complex values here at random from this probability distribution, and then you have a bunch of phi k's. Because you won't get infinitely many of them, which you would really need to be able to do the Fourier transform back to the phi of x. But if you just go to a certain largest value, or largest length of the k vector, then it means that you are covering everything up to a certain wavelength and not smaller wavelengths. About everything from the size of the box to wavelengths down to a certain smallest wavelength, determined by the largest value of k that you have. And then in practice, all you have to do is take those phi k values, invert the Fourier series using the formula that we had in the last lecture, and then you obtain phi of x drawn from the probability distribution, and then you can see how a typical fluctuating field looks. Now, today we will recover that result from a different perspective that, in fact, doesn't require one to go back to the Q's of the P's. And for that purpose, we will use the Schrödinger picture. We will introduce, by the other way around, we will introduce the Schrödinger picture, and as part of it, we will show how that Gaussian distribution arises in this way. So look at the irony of it. We started out in this course with the Schrödinger equation. Then we said, it's no good. We have to do the Klein-Gödel equation. We said, that's no good. We have to do the second quantization of it. And now I seem to come full circle and talk about the Schrödinger equation. Yes, there's going to be a Schrödinger equation, but it's a level higher. It's the second quantized series Schrödinger equation, Schrödinger picture. What do we have to do first for the Schrödinger equation? Well, the Schrödinger equation in ordinary quantum mechanics is all about wave functions and how they evolve in time. For example, position wave functions or momentum wave functions. Yeah, to calculate how they evolve in time, it's part of the Schrödinger picture to put the time evolution not on the operators, but on the states. That's part of the Schrödinger equation. The other part of the typical Schrödinger equation is that you choose a basis, such as the position eigenvectors, for example, or the momentum eigenvectors. So we will have to do two things here in order to get a Schrödinger equation for quantum field theory. First is, we'll have to define the analog of wave functions and allow them to be time dependent. That's what we will do to start with. And then we look at the Schrödinger equation and see how we can solve it. Okay, so first, wave functions. The analog in quantum field theory of wave functions are wave functionals. And what the difference is, we will see in a moment. So for now, assume that at the time t, we do a measurement. And we choose to measure all the observables phi of x simultaneously. This is going to be the analog, first quantization, of saying that, well, assume we have the first quantization, lots of operators, q1, q2, etc., and we measure them all at the time t. They form a complete set of commuting observables, all the position operators. The position operators of the first particle, the position of the second particle, and we measure them all. In fact, it doesn't have to be position operators. Just think of any maximum set of commuting observables at time t, you measure them all. In quantum field theory, those guys form a maximum set of commuting observables. For sure they are commuting. For sure they are self-adjoint. But their maxima, I won't go into the functional analytic details, but it's very plausible because what could be another self-adjoint operator that is commuting with all of them and not made out of the phi? It could only be made out of pi, but the pi don't commute with the phi, right? So all the phi head of x together, for all x, form a set of observables that we can think of as being a maximum set of commuting observables. So now our aim is at time t to measure them all at once. We measure exactly at one time, what's the field amplitude here, what's the field amplitude there, what's the field amplitude there, and so on. And we get a bunch of outcomes. We get a continuum of outcomes. Because at every point in space, we get a measure. And the outcome of that measurement, we get a name. We call it f of x. It's some function, a real valued function, because this thing is self-adjoint. The eigenvalue is a real. We measure the field amplitude in principle. I'm not talking about in practice, but in principle, we measure it and we get a real number at every point. We call that f of x, let's say. So that means that the system now collapses into a new state because we've performed the measurement. We know, just a second, we know that we've measured this amplitude here, that amplitude over there, and so on. So after the measurement, the system is going to be in the joint eigenstate of all those phi hat of x operators with the eigenvalues f of x. So that phi hat of x acting on f on that state into which our system has collapsed is f of x times f. And if you choose another x, you get the corresponding eigenvalue that we measure at the other x.
I thought we were looking for covariant formulations. Why is the word simultaneous there?
Well, remember that we're still in the quick and dirty mode here. We're following, in essence, roughly still the book by Mukhanov and Vinsky, which has the philosophy which we adopt at the moment, that we go very quick and not very thoroughly through some key aspects of quantum field theory. Later on, of course, we will worry about things like that, because there are more than one choice of, there's more than one choice of space like hypersurface in a space time. But this is one choice that you can make.
And that's why it works in the end, because I'm assuming that we're doing this because it works on some.
Yes, right, but others would work as well.
Okay.
Other choices would work as well. You don't have to choose this particular size of space time in hypersurfaces. This works, but others would work as well. I just keep it simple because so far it's only costing space space. Alright, so the point is at every position in space, we measure its operator phi hat, get the real number, and we call that number f. So for each x, we get the number f of x. And the collection of all those f of x, that is the function itself, f of x, it's a collection of the eigenvalues. The name f we use also for the state that the system collapses into. But of course, it's not quite unique, you can always multiply this with a phase, because eigenvectors are always only determined up to a phase. So, anyway, later on we will see that you can't do that, even with the most clever of experimental setups, because any such state F would have to have infinite energy. It's just built into the system. You're always prevented from measuring the field with absolute precision. But if you could, just to make my point, if you could do this, if you had an arbitrarily high energy budget, then you could, in principle, measure all those observables at once. The system would end up in this state. And then what would happen if you measured right away after that, right away, you measure it again? And then you would be sure what you get. You would be sure to find f of x as the value that the field takes everywhere. Because you prepared the system now in its eigenstate. And if it's an eigenstate, its deviation is zero in the prediction of the measurement. So this means that you could, for example, take a picture, an image of a beach with palm trees all around, and view it as a function. It's just the brightness curve of it. You could view it as a function of space. And then, in principle, you can find the state of the quantum field theory, an eigenstate to quantum field theory, which has those brightness values as its eigenvalues, so that if you measured all the phi hat of x, you would get this picture, in principle. But in practice, of course, you never have an infinite energy budget. You can never write down that eigenstate. You can never prepare that eigenstate. The most you can do is some sort of version of it which has some, at least, random fluctuation. You never get a clear picture.
So this just says that phi can be written as a linear combination of those f's.
phi? No. Phi hat is an operator. That's its argument.
Oh. What I mean is a state.
Yes, the f's are the eigenvalues, and the corresponding eigenstate, which is eigenstates to all of the phi hat of x, and its eigenvalues with respect to each one of those phi of x, are given by the f of x, and that state is a state in the Hilbert space, what you call f. So now, if f from R3 to R is an arbitrary function, then you can define for it a state in the Hilbert space, which is an eigenvector to all of those phi hat of x operators, and the eigenvalues are given by that function. Eigenvectors again unique up to a phase prefactor. So for any function f from R3 into R, we have a state f such that it is eigenvector to all of those operators for all of the x with those pre-specified eigenvalues, in principle. Now, of course, in practice, we cannot take those f out of the space of all functions. It would have to be some nice functions, but let us not get sidetracked into the precise specifications of that function space. You would want it to be at the very least square integrable, but that's not enough. Now, the set of all those vectors that we can get in this way, the set of all joint eigenvectors of the phi hat of x is the set of all joint eigenvectors of a maximal set of commutating observables, and therefore should form an orthonormal basis. It can be made into an orthonormal basis by commutation. Which means that we can write down the resolution of the identity in this way. We can say that any state in the quantum field theory can also be written in this way, for example. That we sum over, integrate over, all of those possible eigenstates. We sum over all joint eigenstates of the observables phi hat of x, and that gives us the resolution of the identity, which we can let act on the psi, and we get this expression here, where this, as we recognize, is the wave function of a state in a particular basis. And if you have, in quantum mechanics, if you have a state psi, and you have some observable r with eigenvalues little r, and eigenstates r, then this is what we would call the wave function of psi in the r eigenbasis. So in this case here, we've chosen as the maximal set of commuting observables the phi hat of x. Just like here, this could be a maximum set of commuting observables with eigenvalues Ri, and the R could be the collection R1, R2, etc. And then here, remember this is really collection R1, R2, R3, etc. This gives us a psi of R. This is the wave function, now depending on several variables. And in quantum mechanics, it's always a countable number of variables. But in quantum field theory now, we have an uncountable number of variables because we have for every x, we have a phi hat. So we come now to the wave function now. In quantum mechanics, or roughly what I had over here, quantum mechanics, assume that the R hat I form a maximum set of commuting observables. With joint eigenvectors, we denote by R, where R is really short for the set R1, R2, R3, up to Rn, that are joint eigenvectors of all those observables. Then the wave function psi in the R basis is simply psi of R in the bracket of R plus psi. And this is what is called the wave function of the state psi in the R hat basis. You will replicate just the same thing now. And for example, you could choose as the maximum set of commuting observables in quantum mechanics the set of all the momentum operators. And then we obtain by this procedure the momentum wave function. Now, in quantum field theory, the maximum set of commuting observables is the set of the phi hat of x, for example. We could also choose the set of the pi hat of x. They also commute with another. In fact, they form a complete set of commuting observables. But for our purposes, while making more complicated than necessary, let's look at those guys. They form a maximum set of commuting observables. And we're looking at their joint eigenvectors. The joint eigenvectors will be denoted by f. They obey that if we act with any one of those observables on f, we get an eigenvalue, namely f of x. So now we define the wave functional. And for wave functionals, I'm using this character psi, at least when I don't forget, which is charged with here on top and then at the bottom. The wave functional for a state psi, the wave functional psi, is this thing here, and the square brackets indicate that it's a functional, and it's defined to be the bracket between the state, the Hilbert space state that our quantum field theory is in, and this collection of, and then this joint eigenvector of all our observables. Just the same thing as over here, where the R is really the connection has in it the information about all of the eigenvalues, right? R1, R2, R3, etc. But similarly here, the F stands for the F of X. So this is called a wave functional. Now, why a functional? What is a function anyway? A function usually has as an argument, it has a number or perhaps several numbers. Right? A functional is traditionally something that takes as its argument a function and then gives you a number out of it. So in quantum mechanics, this psi of R is just a function. You plug in some eigenvalues there and you get a complex number. Here, similarly, this wave functional is such that you plug a function, f, or f of x, really, and you get out a number, a complex number. And what number is it? Right? It's what you get when you take the bracket between the state of the system and the eigenstate that has f of x as its collection of eigenvalues. What is the interpretation of psi hat of f? Now that's great that this thing has an interpretation. Because as I told you, when we went from the Schrödinger wave function to the Klein-Gordon field, we lost the interpretation of the field. Now the Schrödinger equation, we weren't able to say in the Schrödinger equation, the regular Schrödinger equation for wave function, ordinary quantum mechanics, we know that the modulus squared gives us the probability for something to happen, right? You know how to calculate this stuff. But then the Klein-Gordon field can't be treated like that. You just can't take the square of the modulus of the Klein-Gordon field and take the probability for finding the Klein-Gordon target. Because it's all messed up with the other part. And in any case, in the complete theory, we have to do the second calculation. So now, we have obtained wave functionals, and it turns out that they have the traditional kind of interpretation. Namely, assume that the system is in an arbitrary state, psi, at the particular time t. Then, if we are now measuring the psi hats of x and t at all the positions, then we can ask, what is the probability amplitude for finding a particular function f of x as the outcome of all those measurements. Well, all we have to do is take the eigenvector, the joint eigenvector f that corresponds to all those eigenvalues, it has all those eigenvalues, and take the bracket of it with psi, the state in which our system is in. The modulus square of that is the probability for finding this. It's the probability for finding a particular field configuration when the system, a particular field configuration described by a function f, if the system is in a state trial. And that is, by our definition of the wave function here, simply the modulus squared of the wave function. So in other words, if you want to know what's the probability amplitude for finding a quantum field in a particular shape, in a particular set of amplitudes, given by a function f of x, then you can ask the wave function now, feed it that function, and it will spit out the probability amplitude for finding it.
Sure. Usually in quantum mechanics, what we do is we say the probability finding between x and x plus dx will be the probability amplitude times dx. What exactly would we do in this case?
Yeah, here you would have to integrate over the function space.
Yeah.
And we will later do that, integrating over function spaces, the very end of the course, and we do the planet part integral. But for now, it's too early because it would really be a messy business to do this. But there is a there's a way to avoid that, and you will do this. Namely, you can work with wave functionals in quantum field theory, it doesn't have to be wave functionals. You can also work with wave functions. If by that, I don't mean that everything changes completely back to first quantization. No, we stay in second quantization, but the reason why it is a wave function now is that we feed functions, right, rather than sets of numbers. But what happens if, instead of describing our field configurations in position space, where it's continuous, we put the system in a box, infrared regularized, and then describe our field configurations in momentum space through the discrete set of Fourier coefficients? Well, then we get a wave function because it will depend on this set of Fourier coefficients rather than on a continuum function. So instead of feeding our wave function an f of x, a function f of x, and get the probability amplitude for finding this, when you do the Fourier transform, Fourier series transform, we can feed our wave function a function f tilde of k, Fourier transform coefficient, and there's only count of a set of those. And we feed those into the wave function, or which we may then also call a wave function, and get out probability amplitude. It's of course the same one. We've just calculated it in a different way by different choice of bases. And it has more advantages because functional differentiations will turn into regular differentiations. We will make use of that a few slides further down. So what we've achieved now is the first step in going to the Schrödinger equation, namely introduce the analog of wave functions, the wave functionals. Now, the next thing is we make them time dependent. We change to the Schrödinger picture in which the operators are frozen in time, and it's the states that evolve in time, which also means that the wave functionals evolve in time, or the wave function that they can use. So what is the equation of motion for the wave functionals? And the answer is, it's the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation. For this, we have to remember that for every quantum theory, be it relativistic or non-relativistic, be it quantum field theory or first quantization, for every quantum theory, in the Schrödinger picture, this is the time evolution. The time evolution, this equation can be derived from the Heisenberg equations of motion that we had before. It's just a change of basis. Just do a unitary within certain kinds of bases that is time dependent in such a way that we shift the time evolution that used to be in the operators into the time evolution of the state. So this is a mere matter of functional analysis to have this thing. And it holds in every quantum theory. Now we know what our Hamiltonian is in the quantum theory, and we just introduce the wave functionals, so we should be able to handle this thing. But not quite completely yet. Because we know what happens to the abstract states. We can write them now as wave functionals. the ordinary Schrödinger equation, I dt psi equals h psi. Ordinarily, we would say, okay, we can represent those by psi, well, of t, sorry, of t. And we would say, okay, we know how to do this now, how to represent an abstract state as a wave function or wave function there, same here, but and we can calculate the time derivative, but we still have to represent the Hamiltonian as acting on wave functions. In quantum mechanics, what we have is that the Hamiltonian is something like 1/2 e hat squared plus 1/2 omega squared x squared. And in quantum mechanics, we know how to handle this situation. We know that we can represent the x operator as a multiplication operator on wave functions, and the p operator as a differentiation operator, well, minus I times a differentiation operator on the wave functions. We have to do a similar thing over here now. Now, how to get the wave function f, namely simply by taking the bracket with an f. But what about the, how do we represent it? How do we represent its operators in the phi hat or the pi hat by actions on wave functions?
So that means that we have to replace x by f.
No. Just wait a moment, we get to it. That's right. So, which form does this Schrödinger equation take for wave function f? Well, here in quantum field theory, this is our Hamiltonian. But how do the phi hat, which occur here, and the pi hat, which occur there, act on wave functions? Sorry, here's a valid representation. Just like in quantum mechanics, it's not unique. You can choose position representation, momentum representation, and so on. But here's a representation, namely a valid representation of these commutation relations. A valid representation, therefore, of how the phi hat and the pi hat act on wave functionals is this one, namely, in complete analogy to what we did in classical mechanics. In first quantization, where we did say that the position operator acting on the wave function psi of x, and I'm using these dots to indicate the action of the operator, the abstract operator on the wave function, is given by multiplying with x, and the action of p hat psi of x. Okay, I used to call them Q, I think, at some point, because I want to make sure that you don't confuse them with the X over here. Q equal to minus I dQ of Q. And if you have several position operators, then you just put an I, or let's say A here, and then it's a QA over there, PA, E by B, QA. The point being that the action of the phi hat is to multiply the wave function with the eigenvector. And the action of P on psi is to differentiate with respect to the I. Here, we try the same thing. Psi hat should have an action on the wave function such that it multiplies with the eigenvalue. Remember that the x corresponds to the AD. Okay? For every value of x, we have another operator here. For every value of a, we have another operator. So we have the action of any one of those operators on the psi given by eigenvalue acting on f, acting on the wave function. And similarly, the action of the pi hat on the wave function is given by functional differentiation. Now, at this point, I don't want to introduce yet functional differentiation. Let me just say it's the same thing as what you have encountered when you study the variational principle used to derive the Euler Lagrange equation. As it turns out, we can avoid working with it by going to the Fourier transform, because there we won't be dealing with the continuum of values x, but with the discrete set of values k. And so what is a functional derivative here will turn into regular, ordinary, partial derivatives there. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, I leave it to you as an exercise to check that this really works out. The only thing you need for that is to know that d by df of x, f of x prime, is equal to delta 3x minus x prime. Or, if you you can also show that, and that's really what you need in this, is that minus I d by using this over there, d by d f of x, f of x. I don't want to give it on. You know, this should suffice so that you then can verify that this communication relation holds. All you do is apply these actions on a wave function, basically put a wave function here, put a wave function there, and verify. It's just the usual thing. Works the same way as ordinary derivatives, except that now it's for functional derivatives. Alright, so if we do that now, the Hamiltonian acts on wave functions like this. The momentum operator, the momentum field operator, acts by functional differentiation, and we have two of them, so we get a minus second derivative, and then we replace the phi that used to be here by multiplying with the f. And then we have a representation of the Hamiltonian. A little bit inconvenient because this plus operator here is going to act non-trivially on any position dependence that's afterwards. That's another reason why we want to use the Fourier representation. But you see, in principle, we are ready already at this point to write down the Schrödinger equation, because we know how the Hamiltonian acts on wave functions. But we won't do it in this representation because it's a bit tedious given the derivatives of the Laplacian and given that we deal with functional derivatives. It's more convenient to use the infrared regularized momentum space. So if you want to do in momentum space, and we already know how the Hamiltonian looks like in momentum space, then we need to represent this commutation relation on the wave functionals. And the wave functionals in momentum space are fed not the fields f of x, but they are fed the coefficients f tilde index k. So the wave functional now is psi of the set of Fourier coefficients And of course, it's time dependent because it's a predictor. So as it's easy to verify, and I need to check to do that, this answer should work. We take this operator here and represent it on those wave functionals as multiplying with those Fourier coefficients after the k. And the momentum operator, the Fourier coefficient is fundamentally complicated momentum operators, act on the wave functionals as minus I divided the f tilde of minus k. Notice there's a minus here. We need a minus here because we have to represent these commutation relations here, which have that minus over there. But that's a minor technical difficulty. It's actually not difficulty at all. It's straightforward to do this. Okay. And you notice that now we only need ordinary differentiation. This is a regular partial derivative. Because the k take only the discrete values. Therefore, there's only a discrete set of those variables. Only a discrete set of Fourier coefficients. Remember that the k are triplets, which take those values here, 2 pi over l, and then here integers, positive or negative integers. So now, let us use the momentum representation to write down the Schrödinger equation. Schrödinger equation is I dt, the wave function for the abstract state, and then momentum squared plus, and then here we have what used to be the phi squared or phi Laplacian sin squared phi, and here we have the wave function again. So recognize that this here is the whole time. So you see what this does? It says that if you take the time derivative of the wave function L, you should get the same as if you acted with this thing on the wave function. You differentiate it with respect to f to the minus k and with respect to f to the k. Sorry, I made a mistake here, which is this sum rather than the integral. Okay. Because they take only discrete values. And apply that to this. So what do we have to find mathematically? We have to find a little machine psi, a wave function L, which you can feed a set of Fourier coefficients f tilde, f tilde k. In a time-dependent fashion, so I mean, the little machine is time-dependent, such that if you did, and you get out a number, right? So you feed it a set of Fourier coefficients, and you get out a complex number, the probability amplitude for finding those Fourier coefficients, right? So you have to find a little mathematical machine, a wave function, which is time-dependent, and whenever you feed it a set of Fourier coefficients, it gives you a complex number in such a way. But when you differentiate this little machine with respect to the time, you get the same as if you do this with it, multiply with the Fourier coefficients and differentiate with respect to its dependence on those Fourier coefficients. Sounds perhaps like a terrible task, but it's not so hard to actually do this. It's just a bit unusual perhaps. Remember that in first quantization, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator looks like this in Schrödinger. Because now in the Schrödinger picture, we have time dependence as well. Before that, when we worked in the Heisenberg picture, there was no time dependence and this term was absent. Basically, this term was absorbed in the evolution of the operator. But in the Schrödinger picture, this is how the ground state wave function looks like. So we would expect that the ground state solution, the lowest energy solution to the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory is roughly that form. And it does actually. And here it is.
Do that.
You might also want to get rid of the G3X in the sum.
Yes, good idea. Yeah. So, the claim is that this is the solution for the lowest energy. It's the lowest energy solution. Obviously, there are going to be a lot of solutions. That's just like the harmonic oscillator has better solutions, and infinity theory has can be more solutions because it has so many oscillators. Anyway, independent of that, this is the solution, as you can say, pretty straightforwardly. All you have to do is take this wave function there, or function in this case, and plug it here and over there, differentiate on this side to get down the pi omega k, and differentiate on that side to get those terms down, and play with this stuff, and check whether this equation holds. It's a little exercise, I'm sure you can do this. Now let us look at what this is. Apart from the time dependence, which we can get if we choose the Heisenberg picture, this is exactly what we had done before. Namely that the probability amplitude for finding a particular field configuration specified by its Fourier series coefficients is proportional to, this is a normalization constant, proportional to these terms here. Where this is basically Gaussian, because this is the modulus square. Remember that f tilde of minus k is the same as f index k star. Therefore, this is the modulus square. Which is what we have already trained before, and so we cover that. And you see the nice thing here now is that we don't need to work with the q and the p on waves. We don't have to reduce it to that. We can do it directly. And that's basically because the functional derivatives and regular derivatives that we dealt with here don't really care about whether or not they correspond to Savage-Under operating or not. See, the point is that these representations work, but they're unlike the representations that we would have been used to find them again. Because this is not a Savage-Under operator, and neither is that. But for the purpose of getting a representation of the commutation relations that you have to assume, this is fine. And that is what allows us to proceed and to get a representation of the Schrödinger equation like that, and then to quickly check that this is the solution. Now, how would we get other solutions? How would we get excited solutions? Well, remember that we know how the excited solutions look like for the regular quantum harmonic oscillators. Namely, they are not just this, but they are that term, and then in front are so-called Hamming polynomials. And what you can try is putting Hamming polynomials of those F tilde in a suitable way by adjusting the energy property, and then you will get more solutions. You can get solutions where one or several or all of those oscillators are excited. And this way you can build up a complete set of solutions. Check it. I would find it great if some of you were to try this and then draw coefficients, Fourier coefficients, from that, from an excited solution, and perhaps plot that, because then you would see not just the quantum fluctuations in an image, but also the wave that corresponds to the excitation of a particular oscillator that, for a particular mode oscillator, for a particular wave, and then on top of that, the quantum fluctuations. It's interesting because it's not a linear superposition. The quantum fluctuations are not just a linearly superimposed noise on top of a way of describing the particle traveling, because the whole thing is, and the probability distributions don't just add up. It's more complicated than that. So generic wave functionals are others. They don't even have to be eigenfunctions to the harmonic oscillator. That's just one way of getting energy eigenstates. But in general, the state of the quantum system could be arbitrary. And if we call that state alpha, then if it's not the vacuum state, then it's by definition an excited state. Now, if it is an excited state, then the wave function L or wave function spreads out. By that I mean this. Let's look at harmonic oscillator eigenstates, just because we know how they look. If we are in a ground state, then the probability amplitude that we just calculated, the wave function now for the Fourier coefficient, is Gaussian distributed. Right? This is the message of our solution here, namely that the probability amplitude for finding a particular Fourier coefficient, fk, is given by a constant times minus frequency times the modulus squared. So large amplitudes are suppressed more than exponential. They are expressed like minus f squared. Just to say that in this case, the probability for finding very large Fourier coefficients is suppressed. We are likely to find small Fourier coefficients, which means that we are likely to find small amplitudes for phi of x too. If its Fourier coefficients are small, then phi of x itself is also small. Now, if one of those harmonic oscillators is very large excited, then we are likely to find very large values of phi of the Fourier coefficient. Okay, but then if that's the case, if you find a very large value of phi k, then it means that it will impact the phi of x by producing a nice big waveform. I think we discussed that already. All right, so are there any questions so far on the wave picture? Because I'd like to move on to the particle interpretation of quantum field theory. All of this so far has been about measuring field amplitudes and waves and all of that. Any further questions on this? Because if not, we start with the particle interpretation. Okay, particle interpretation. General states, states alpha that are not the ground state, are states with particles. Why would that be justified? What do those harmonic oscillators have to do with particles? And this question will occupy us today and also next Tuesday. First of all, could it work out energetically? Remember that the Hamiltonian takes this form, Hamiltonian to quantum field theory, and, oh, I should say, we're back to the Heisenberg picture now for now. She doesn't really matter whether you're in Heisenberg or not. So the Hamiltonian looks like this, and you recognize that we were in Heisenberg picture by the operators having time to think. And you see that it's really the sum of Hamiltonians. It's the sum of a Hamiltonian for each mode. Now, an energy eigenstate of the quantum field theory is therefore also an eigenstate for each one of those hk. Those guys are commuting. You can all diagonalize them simultaneously. And so, that's the situation. We can look at them individually. So this means that any eigenstate, let's call it E, of the quantum field theory, every energy eigenstate of the quantum field theory, is specified by what it means for each individual harmonic oscillator. So if we have an energy eigenstate, an eigenstate to this full thing, then we can completely describe it by inferring what kind of eigenstate is for this operator for each value of k. Because it has to be an eigenstate of all those guys as well. So this means that an energy eigenstate of the quantum field theory can be specified by listing to which energy level the oscillator of mode k is excited. So for every mode k, and remember we have a discrete, we have a countable set of harmonic oscillators, we have a countable set of modes. And for each mode oscillator, we can specify how much it is excited. Is it in the third excited state or the fifth excited state and so on. So we have a huge list of excitation numbers. For every wave vector, we have its amount of excitation. We know it's going to be an integer because by construction, we want to look, by definition, we only want to look at energy eigenstates. So energy eigenstates are completely described by telling how much each one of the mode oscillators is excited. So for example, an energy eigenstate of the quantum field theory can be described by giving the following list. We say that there's a momentum Ka, there is a wave factor Ka, whose mode oscillator is in its third excited state. And then there is another wave factor Kb, whose harmonic oscillator, mode oscillator, is in its seventh excited state. And all other wave vectors have harmonic oscillators that are here on the state, that are not excited, in the zero excited state. That's the complete specification of this set. Of course, if we put it, that would be a state in which you have one oscillator three-fold excited, another oscillator seven-fold excited. So this is an eigenstate to the HKA and to the HKB, and also to all other HKs. And it is an eigenstate with eigenvalue 7 times omega k4 HKA, and it's an eigenstate with eigenvalue 7.13. With eigenvalue omega kb and 7. This means that the energy is given in this way. If I apply the entire Hamiltonian on that energy eigenstate, then I get a contribution of 3 h bar omega from one mode oscillators HK, and the other mode oscillators have a charge of uses 7 omega kb with respect to this oscillator's frequency. And then, of course, we get also the sum of all 1/2 h bar omega, the ground state energies of all the mode oscillators. But we won't be interested in this particular thing because it's always present, it's just an overall constant, and you can always normalize that away. Now, as long as there's no gravity, you can always neglect the finite amount of energy consistently. Classically speaking, classical mechanics, you can always add to the energy a finite amount, it doesn't make a difference.
Well, the energy is always measured with respect to reference.
No, the point is that in classical mechanics, the dynamics is that can be described in terms of forces, which are the derivative of energy. A constant drops out of all forces. You take the total Hamiltonian and constant don't show any forces. And in quantum mechanics without gravity, similar story. If you have a Hamiltonian and you add to it a constant times the identity, then that will drop out in the equation of motion. If you calculate the Heisenberg equation of motion, I q hat dot, and the derivative of any observable q, then it is the commutator of q hat with the Hamiltonian. And whether or not there is a constant times the identity, it drops out because everything commutes with the constant. So we won't be concerned with this. Ultimately, of course, we will be very much concerned with this business because energy gravitates. So this is one of the main goals that we are covered for the now. For the moment, let's not worry about it just yet. The main point I want to make here is that if we increase the excitation number of a mode k by 1, if we go from 3 to 4, if we increase the excitation of one oscillator, then what does it mean for the overall energy of our one? It means it goes up by omega k. It goes up by, if you reinsert the h bar, goes up by h bar omega k. So the total energy increases by this amount. Okay? By the square root of k squared over m squared for that particular mode. But now let us remember from special relativity that for a particle, we have that its energy squared minus its momentum squared is its mass squared. Which is to say that the energy of a particle is just that, which is what we call the frequency of the. So therefore, energetically, things seem to work out. If we say that if we increase the excitation level of the harmonic oscillator of those nodes, then we create a particle. We describe one more particle. Because energetically, this is what the energetic expense of that is. So the interpretation that we are led to here, by no means the derivation of it, of the interpretation, we will get to that in the next lecture on Tuesday. But the following interpretation is consistent with the energetics, namely the interpretation that the mode excitation corresponds to the description of an extra particle. Whenever you excite the mode, it's energetically as if you had added another particle with the corresponding wave factor. Now, in practice, this interpretation is not going to work. It's going to work in Minkowski space very well. But only if you don't accelerate things. And it's the standard interpretation that you use for particle physics, but as you will see on curved space and expanding space, it's not that easy. The reason is that, for one thing, the choice of mode oscillators, if you remember, was not trivial. It was in principle ambiguous. And so we shouldn't expect that there is an ambiguous interpretation of that kind. In fact, as we will see, there are circumstances when there is no particle interpretation. For example, during cosmic inflation, there was a period in which there was no particle interpretation, as we see. But still, the field interpretation makes sense. Right, so what we will do next time is we will identify particles in the literature. We basically say, let's put a detector into a quantum field and try to detect particles and see what it does. And then we'll see how the excitation of fields translates into the detection of particles. Okay, any questions? Please try at least some of those exercises. I'm expecting certain equations.